If you've ever tried to find a map showing the feeder pattern for the Pittsburgh Public Schools, you might have come up empty. The school district says it doesn't have a map it can give to the public that shows which schools kids are assigned to based on where they live. So we made one, and when we looked at the map, we saw lots of stories. This is Dividing Lines, the Shape of Education in Pittsburgh, a podcast from 90.5 WESA. I'm Liz Reed. Today, we look at why families live where they live. Margaret J. Krause reports, for many families, this question has often not been a free market choice. A warning for our audience, this story contains strong, racially charged language.
The double yellow line that runs down the middle of Thomas Boulevard in North Point Breeze separates east and westbound traffic. But on the 7200 block, that same yellow line separates Alderdice High School students from their Westinghouse Academy counterparts. Stand on the northern sidewalk, and it's Westinghouse Bulldogs all the way. But cross the yellow line, and it's Alderdice Dragons territory. The academic achievement at Alderdice is roughly double what it is at Westinghouse, but with fewer than half the number of economically disadvantaged students. That's not an accident.
Come on in, dear.
Albert French bought his house on Thomas Boulevard in 1976. He looked for another apartment in Shadyside, but most landlords weren't keen on his German Shepherd, Inchon.
So I thought I just would buy a damn house and be the landlord, and me and Inchon could, have a place to live. Inchon's buried right out in the backyard. Okay.
French lived in one part of the house and rented the others as apartments. He took out an ad in the paper where he worked as a photographer, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
It would not be uncommon for one of the first questions to be asked, what side of Penn Avenue is this on?
French is a United States Marine veteran who nearly had his head blown off in Vietnam. He did not like this question.
They're really asking, is this on the white side or the black side? I remember being very frustrated with it and telling them it was on the American side and hang up the damn phone.
A home is the biggest investment most people will ever make, financially and emotionally, as well as the single greatest source of wealth for most Americans. That engine of social mobility was categorically denied to black families for decades, while allowing white families to build security, says Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute.
They used that wealth to send their children to college. They used it to subsidize their own retirements. They used it to take care of medical emergencies or temporary bouts of unemployment. And they use it to bequeath wealth to their own children or grandchildren for down payments on their homes.
Class is now a more reliable predictor of academic achievement than race. What residential segregation did throughout the 20th century was create a wealth gap along largely racial lines. And that now manifests in performance outcomes in Pittsburgh public schools.
It wasn't the unintended effect of otherwise benign policies.
Rothstein wrote a book called The Color of Law, a forgotten history of how our government segregated America. The feds built segregated public housing in the 1930s. They built segregated defense housing in World War II. During the post-war suburban building boom, the feds refused to insure mortgages if they allowed resale to black families.
These were racially explicit policies of the federal government, and state and local as well, designed to ensure that African Americans and whites could not live near one another, that we've never remedied, and that we all have forgotten.
It all starts with the flaming tailspin of the Great Depression, when the federal government got into the housing market in a big way. In 1933, the economy was still finding rock bottom, and nearly 1,000 families a day lost their homes. The government began to buy delinquent mortgages and sell them, newly backed by treasury bonds. And at the same time, they revamped lending to prevent another large-scale housing collapse. For a while, the U.S. government dominated the housing scene. But here's the thing. They didn't really have any housing expertise, says Devin Rutan, who studied redlining in Pittsburgh.
They hire all of these lenders, appraisers, real estate agents who are saying it's really dangerous to lend in a majority black neighborhood, or having an Eastern European individual in the neighborhood makes it riskier that all of these homes are going to go downhill.
The federal underwriting manual warned against inharmonious racial groups and the infiltration of lower class occupancy. The authors and their biases had an outsized lasting effect on society when they decided who was a good bet for a loan and who wasn't.
A lot of these communities have faced 60 or 70 years of disinvestment. And the city today very much resembles a Depression-era version of itself.
By 1968, the U.S. made housing discrimination illegal. The wage gap between black and white workers was the slimmest it has ever been, so more families could afford to buy homes. But private prejudice remained.
Realtors, realizing they had all this pent-up money, decided to blockbust. I watched it.
That's Ralph Proctor. He was a civil rights leader and teaches at the Community College of Allegheny County. Blockbusting is when homeowners are persuaded to sell out of fear. Realtors told white homeowners property values would drop and they'd lose their investment.
You go to the neighbors and you start saying, sell me a house. And they say no. Why should they? They've been there forever. It's a nice home. But you need that house in order to sell it to black folks because you know it can sell it to them for more money. Okay? And they always use the ghost, the niggers are coming.
In many cases, the first sale was crucial, says Proctor, because suddenly there was proof that the thing homeowners feared was real and had arrived.
It's like these signs had been spring-loaded into their lawns, and they went in the house and pushed a button, and the for sale signs came up all over the neighborhood.
Michael Eichler says blockbusting only works if black and white neighbors don't talk about it. Eichler's first job in Pittsburgh was trying to stop the practice in Perry North, one of the city's integrated neighborhoods. To expose it, he'd find two couples, one black and one white. They'd have the same income, the same savings, the same goals. The white couple would be told, don't move to Perry Hilltop, it's a slum. Have you thought about the North Hills? The black couple would be told Perry Hilltop was a beautiful community.
And the black couple was trained to say, well, what about the North Hills? And the agent would say, there's nothing you can afford there.
Look at the schools in those areas today. A quarter of residents at North Hills High School are economically disadvantaged, compared to more than 80% at Perry High School. It lags behind the North Hills in graduation rates, too. Albert French says what he and his neighbors were aiming for in North Point Breeze in the 1970s was a community where anyone who had the money could buy a home and put down roots. While Pittsburgh remains one of the most segregated cities in the U.S., French says he thinks attitudes have gotten better.
I think the whole thing here is to improve a neighborhood and to be open to other people with respect. That's the answer.
A young family lives in the house next door to him. They have four little kids, and the youngest likes to chat with French when they're both outside. At least once a month, French gets a letter asking if he'd like to sell his home. He says he's not going anywhere. Margaret J. Krause, 90.5 WESA News.
Tomorrow, we'll investigate the district's 30-year effort to desegregate the schools. Find more at wesa.fm/dividinglines.